Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
See, I'd like to make sure that everybody has a chair or a cushion. Are there people out there on the porch, or is everybody okay? Because we can. There are more chairs in here, and we can accommodate everybody. So, Guy, I think people will be coming in late, so maybe they can. You can put chair. Have chairs back there for them?
Okay. There's more chairs back there.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. So I'm Tim Burkett, head teacher at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and welcome to our Sunday talk. This morning I'm very happy to introduce my very new old friend and teacher, Red Pine. He's new in that I just met him on Thursday. He's old in that he's a very old man. He's my age. And I found out that we actually went to high school within a mile of each other. But he's also old for me in that I have been reading him his books since about 1983 when his first book came out. And I have been appreciating his translation, and not just his translations, but the spirit in which he translates. Because he doesn't translate with dryness, as he was explaining yesterday. He translates with life. Well, the life of the old teachers comes through his translations, and he has 15 translations of Chinese texts, Chinese poetry, sutras. The Platform Sutra, many of which we've studied here, and two of which we studied yesterday with him. So this is his bidding adieu to us before he goes back to the West Coast. And some of you have never met him. He's going to stay and sign books if you'd like to buy one of his books or just hang out with him. He understands that we'll be starting with a chant. He's done a lot of chanting in China. So I just want to welcome him from the bottom of my heart.
We invite you to join us in the opening chant, which was found in this card.
So rare to touch a deep and subtle karma, having it to see and hear, remember and become, we vow to taste the truth that is right here and yet so far beyond words.
Does this microphone pick me up? It does, it's fine? Okay. Well, no one ever asked me to give a Dharma talk before, so don't excuse me if I don't talk much about the Dharma. But I had a dinner last night with some friends, and we had 6 bottles of wine between us. So I'm going to, I guess, just talk about what I'll give you some background about myself and about what I do and how I go about it. I thought that might be a good idea. Because I have a name card. I didn't bring any with me, but I actually have a name card because when you travel in China, if you don't have a name card, you don't really exist. You have to, you know, it's sort of your authentication. When I first started traveling in China, I was a journalist. And so I put that on my name card. But of course, journalists soon became persona non grata in China, and so then I changed it to Bill Porter, a writer, and then after a few years, writers also became bad news. And so now my name card just says Bill Porter, translator, and that's what I finally realized. That's what I am. I'm a translator. I love to translate, and that's never planned to become one. I guess if I outline how I got here, I was born in 1943 in Los Angeles. My father was from Arkansas and my mother was from Michigan. my father had a hotel business after he got out of prison, where he had been for 6 years for bank robbery. He used proceeds from the sale of their cotton farm down in Arkansas to buy a lease on a hotel in Texas, and then parlayed that into a whole series of hotels, so he became really rich. When I was a kid, I always thought we had a printing press down in the basement or somewhere where he printed up money. My mother was one of the first six airline stewardesses in America. So in those days, you had to be a registered nurse to be an airline stewardess, because she told me they used to come down somewhere other than the airport at least once a week. because they were always running out of gas. And the reason for that, I mean, is that they had no radar in those days. They had to fly around weather. So they were always having to choose the person who was going to hitchhike into town. They'd land in farmer fields usually. Somebody's going to have to hitchhike into town. I mean, they could find a town and then they just land outside of it. So these are my two parents that I grew up with in Los Angeles. My father loved to hunt and fish, and so when I was 11, we moved up to the northern panhandle of Idaho, and that's sort of where I grew up in northern Idaho, hunting and fishing, which I really loved, because I had a hard time with the killing. But I loved being outdoors, being alone, because when you hunt, usually you're out by yourself, and fishing too. We usually fly fish, and so usually you work different parts of the stream apart from each other. So I really liked growing up in that sort of environment, and especially being in the wilderness. And then my parents got divorced, and really were angry with each other, and their divorce case lasted 14 years, and all of my father's property was put in receivership because the ownership was contested. So the receivers, ran my father's business into the ground. So he ended up broke, and it was one of the first feelings of joy I experienced, when my father lost all of his money. Because when I grew up very rich, we had maids and servants and all this, and the only people I could ever talk to or that I thought were real were our servants. All the people who would come around, my father's friends, they were all frauds. My parents were obviously nouveau riche. It was new money, and attract new money. Maybe old money's the same. It attracts a lot of the wrong kind of people. That when you're a child, I think your eyes are clearer. And as a child, I saw what money did, and I didn't like it. And I was really happy when finally money was out of my life, and I didn't have to worry about that. I'd like to get a little bit of it back now, but you can't pick and choose. And so I was really relieved when I was sort of set free from having to inherit my father's business and also that way of life. And so I went off to college, and I went to this school just about a mile or a couple miles from where Tim went to school. In fact, one of his best friends was one of my classmates there. Apparently we graduated the same year, class of 25, at this boys' school called Menlo School for Boys. And after I graduated, even though I'd gone to this prestigious school, and I had a fairly good education, I wasn't at all ready for college. And I went to Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara. Remember, my dad dropped me off there, and he said, "So what are you going to study?" And I said, "I don't know. I never thought about it." And so I just went inside the register, and I said, looked at the catalog, and art was right near the top, and I chose art. And I flunked out. I had to leave Santa Barbara, and so I tried a junior college down near San Diego, and I thought, I'll study psychology. that might be better. And I flunked out again. And the third year, I went to Pasadena City College and studied English and flunked out again. So there's sometimes, you know, you're really not ready for certain things that you're expected to do, like going to college. And I, even though I was reasonably intelligent and could take classes and get good grades in high school, I wasn't ready to do that in college, to think for myself. So I got my draft notice. It was in 1964. I guess it was February or so of 64. I remember the Beatles had just arrived in America. And this is when the Vietnam War was heating up, you could say, 64. So I just happened to have a German girlfriend, which is really fortunate, because the Army had this deal when you got drafted for 2 years in those days. If you were willing to extend or sign up for an extra year, they would send you anywhere you wanted to go or give you any training that you wanted. So I asked them to send me to Europe. And so they sent me down to Fort Benning, Georgia to get trained as a Jeep mechanic, and then they were going to send me to Europe. But a week before we were going to graduate, they changed our orders and sent our entire graduating class to Vietnam. And I said, wait, I got a deal. Sergeant Major said, I'm sorry, son, this is the Army. the next day just happened to be payday, and my pay in those days was $68 a month. That was a private's pay. But I took my $68 and I'd had about $150 saved up, and I went AWOL. I left the Army. I hitchhiked, just left, and had some adventures along the way. And I was working my way back towards Idaho, and I got in Montana. I got caught in August. I got caught in a blizzard, and I was down to $5. And so I just decided I'd had enough, so I knew I was going to have to go back to the Army sooner or later. So this is about a month later. I just walked into the nearest little town and turned myself in at the local jail. And then they took me to another jail, and where I spent a week or so waiting for the Army to come and collect me. So I was finally sent back to Fort Benning, Georgia, and I met this sergeant major who was in charge of the whole base, and told him my side of the story, and he said, you know, you're right. You do have a deal. And so he sent me to Germany. And so I spent the Army in Germany, my 2.5 remaining years in the Army in Germany, as a clerk in a medical battalion. And then when I got out, I thought, well, I'll try college one more time, because I had the GI Bill. I think the GI Bill paid me something like around $90 a month. And that was actually enough to live on. In those days. I went back to Santa Barbara, and again, I didn't know what I was going to study, but again, I just looked at the catalog, and the first thing in the catalog was anthropology. And so I decided to study anthropology. And I was ready to learn then, and so I did really well. Studied for 3 years at Santa Barbara. I mean, they sent me, I got a year abroad in Germany at a German university. Studying statistics and mathematical applications. In 1968, I took a year-long course in the first programming language, PL1, because I was interested in computer applications regarding the analysis of human behavior. And then I ran into my first the Dharma. I read this book called The Way of Zen by Alan Watts, and what I'd been learning in my study of mathematics, statistics, and linguistics dovetailed just perfectly with what Alan Watts was talking about in terms of Zen and Buddhism. And I was very impressed not only with the ideas that I was reading about, but with the fact that this wasn't just an intellectual scheme, but this was a way of changing your life. And I just did this my last year in college. I didn't really know what to do about this, this new discovery of mine, this new interest. So I applied to graduate school, and I applied to three graduate schools, and one of them was Columbia University, because I was studying anthropology, and that's where Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict and a lot of great anthropologists were, and they had all this financial aid you could apply for. And one of the the fellowships you could apply for was in language, and you had to write in which language you were going to specialize in. And I just happened to write in the word Chinese. And I didn't know any Chinese. But Alan Watts had all these nice Chinese characters in the back of his book. And I thought, God, that looks fascinating. And of course, they gave me this fellowship. This is a four-year fellowship at Columbia to study anthropology and Chinese on the side. And that's what I did. I went back to New York City and studied anthropology and Chinese and lost total interest in anthropology. And I met a Chinese monk in Chinatown and started meditating with him. And he'd had little weekend retreats sometimes in the countryside north of New York City. And then in the course of 2 years, I finally realized this, what you might say, this conflict of that I was no longer interested in anthropology. And in fact, in the course of 2 years, I never wrote a single paper. Naturally, I took tests when I had to. But I was not interested in anthropology, but I was interested in this Buddhism that I was studying and practicing. And I realized that what I really wanted to do was not know about Buddhism. I wanted to practice it. I wanted to experience it. And so in 1972, after studying anthropology and Chinese for 2 years at Columbia, I finally just quit and gave back the fellowship and went to Taiwan, because one of my fellow graduate students had passed through Taiwan and had stopped at this monastery. He had their address. And so I wrote them and asked them if I could come and stay there. And they said, sure. And so I went to Taiwan and went to this large monastery that was just under construction. In fact, every day we had to carry cement for a couple hours. They're still building it. But there were about 500 monks and nuns there, so it was rather large, and probably that many tourists showed up every day too, to maybe to light some incense. I don't want to call them just tourists; they were like pilgrims. But me being I was the only foreigner in Taiwan who was practicing Buddhism in a monastery, so everybody was curious to see the foreigner, and so it became a very difficult place for me to practice because I was, felt very awkward being stared at all the time. And so, but it was really great. They gave me a room right behind the big shrine hall. So I'd come from America. I'd never really been in a Buddhist setting before, and not like this. And my room was right behind the big shrine hall that was about, the ceiling was about 30 feet high, and the walls were covered with 10,000 Buddha statues. And there was this big Guan Yin statue about 25 feet high. And that was really a very powerful place to practice. I used to go in there every night and meditate. The Chinese in Taiwan at that time weren't much into meditation. They were usually Pure Land Buddhists that chanted the name of the Buddha a lot. And I didn't really quite understand that because it was more devotional. It looked more like Christianity to me. And I was interested in Zen. So after 1 year, I decided this wasn't my kind of setting. So this Chinese friend of mine that I had met encouraged me to go to a Chinese university to improve my Chinese, because my Chinese wasn't getting any better, because in a monastery you don't talk much. A few phrases about all you learn. So I went to a Chinese university for a semester and studied philosophy, and I also met this girl there who was also studying philosophy. And after one semester, I realized I was already sick of school, and I didn't need any more school. So I went and found out about another monastery. There was an actual Zen monastery, and moved into this. The abbot welcomed me and put me up for 2.5 years in his monastery. And I had a great time there, just because I could meditate as much as I wanted. It was in the countryside, so in the mountains, so I could walk into the hills and meditate. And there was a really nice grave mound that I used to meditate every afternoon on. So I lived there for 2.5 years. But every Saturday, I'd walk about 15 minutes through these bamboo groves down to this little teeny town, and there was a train that passed through, and I would take the train into Taipei, which is about a 30-minute train ride, and I would meet this girl. and we would meet at this coffee shop that was opened by the daughter-in-law of Chiang Kai-shek. She was Russian, because her son, her husband had married her in Russia, Zhang Jingguo, Chiang Kai-shek's eldest son. And so she needed a little shop to make pastries for her Russian friends. She opened up this little coffee shop, and that's where all the poets and intellectuals hung out. And it was sort of a neat place, and I met this girl, and together she would go over these Chinese texts that I was trying to learn. In particular, we went over this Buddhist monk's commentary on Zhuangzi, this Taoist text called Zhuangzi. But in particular, we went over this commentary by this very famous Ming Dynasty monk named Han Shan De Qing. And so I did this for a couple of years. And then after 2.5 years, the abbot finally said, you know, you've been here. Well, first of all, when I went there, he took a stick and hit it on the ground on a rock and said, when you hear that, it's time to eat. Otherwise, if you have any questions, just ask. And in 2.5 years, I never had any questions. Well, I did. I would think of a question, but then I would think of the answer. And I felt I really need to, I don't want to bother him about something I have the answer for. Or at least I thought I had the answer for. So I never bothered him with any questions. And so, but after 2.5 years, he finally said, you know, we've been taking care of you for 2.5 years now. He didn't really say it like that. But you've been here for 2.5 years now. Isn't it time you thought about becoming a monk? And I said, I don't think so. I told him I really wouldn't be a very good monk. You see, I've got this girlfriend that I really like, you know, that I see every Saturday. Oh, that's where you've been going. Yeah, and of course he didn't know I always kept a bottle of sherry in my drawer. You know, for a little nip at night. I used to have a little port or sherry. And so he said, well, then you obviously should go on and follow your own path. So before I left, he gave me the Bodhisattva precepts, you know, where the ceremonies were in Taiwan. They take three cones of incense and put some stickum and put them on your arm and then let them burn down. And often you see monks with burn scars on their on their heads. It's something the Chinese got into, putting little cones of incense and letting them burn down as part of a ceremony. So that made him happy that I did that. And so, because he was really a nice master. He was Chiang Kai-shek's master, too. In fact, later when Chiang Kai-shek died, his son Zhang Jingle would come to our monastery a lot, where they would lock us all in our rooms, so we couldn't assassinate him, because he was the president. But so I moved out of this monastery, and I moved to my Chinese friend told me about a farm village on this mountain outside of Taipei, and I found a farmhouse up there on this mountain. The Taipei itself is in a basin; it's basically sea level, but this mountain was it's over 1,000 meters, 3,000 feet. So the farming village was around 2,000 feet. So it's really cool. And the one thing I never got used to in Taiwan was the incredible heat and humidity. And of course I had, like, for example, I had some leather sandals, and they were always green with mildew. Everything mildewed there. Of course, your body rotted away too. And so, but I found this farm village, and it was really cool. It stayed cool all year round. It even snowed in the winter. And so that's where I lived for 14 years, in this farm village. And then I would always try to come up with a way of supporting myself. And the way everybody usually does it in Asia is you teach English. And of course, I did that for about 3 years. I'd go down every Monday, Wednesday, Friday night and teach from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And I'd go take a bus down the mountain. It took about 30 minutes to get down the mountain to this little town. And there were these classes that were always anxious for Westerners to come and teach at. So I made around $300 a month, and my rent was only $100 a month for this really nice little farmhouse. So, in fact, it had the best view probably in all of Taiwan. It was right above Chiang Kai-shek's summer house. His summer house was on a mortar lob below me. but I never had a mortar. I'm not sure of the distance, but it was like it looked like that. About a mortar lob could have done it. So it had a beautiful view and a really lovely place, and I could walk around on this mountain. All the people were farmers in the area, so it was a really nice place to live and to practice. And when I was in the monastery, just about a year before I left, the abbot published the poems, financed the publication of the poems of Cold Mountain, this poet Han Shan, to whom Jack Kerouac had dedicated his book Dharma Bums. And so I had the Chinese text of all these poems for the first time. I'd heard about them because I'd read Dharma Bums, but I never knew I would actually read his poems. And my Chinese was getting better. And the abbot also pirated Burton Watson's English translations of the poems and stuck them in the back. So I could see the English translations and I could see the poems. And I started, in an effort to improve my Chinese, I thought, well, you know, I think I could translate these. And so that's what I started doing. I started translating the poems of Cold Mountain. And I had about 100 of them done when I finally left the monastery. And when I moved to this farming village, the name of the farming village was Juzuhu, or Bamboo Lake. The lake had been drained so they could grow calla lilies and cabbages. So there wasn't a lake anymore, but it was a lovely setting. So I started translating the poems of Cold Mountain and eventually translated all 300 of them and found a publisher through an American friend I met at a party in Taiwan who introduced me to this press in Port Townsend, Washington, where I now live. It's called Copper Canyon Press. And they publish poetry, and Han Shan was a poet, so they agreed to publish my translations. And this book I had of Cold Mountain's poetry, someone had also put some more poems of it by another poet right after it, a man named Stonehouse, who was a much better poet than Cold Mountain. And nobody had ever really heard of this guy before. Somebody had, because they put his poems in there. So I just kept translating, and I translated Stonehouse's poems. And then I had this little book that I had for some time of Bodhidharma's teachings, and I started translating that. And I never planned to translate at all. I started translating just to improve my Chinese. That was the only reason. But I discovered, while I'm translating, I discovered that in order to translate something, you really have to get into it. You can't just read it and think you understand it, because you have to come up with so the words in your language that replicates, that mirrors that text. And so it was really a challenge that I really loved. I loved the experience of that. And so I became a translator and just started doing this. And I published all my own, except for the book that was published in America by Copper Canyon, I published 4 books by myself. That is, I would have them bound by a local binder and just distribute them among friends. And then it was about that time that the parents of this girl, after 7 years, finally agreed to let me marry her. But they said there were some conditions they had set for me to marry her. And they said, well, first of all, you have to stop living on the floor, because Taiwan had been under the control of the Japanese until 45. And so everybody lived on tatamis. And so they insisted I buy furniture. And so I had to buy some furniture. And I had to buy some gold bracelets and a necklace and rings. And I had to take their daughter on a honeymoon to Japan, if at all possible. And it had to be a month long, not a short one, but a long one. And there had to be this wedding banquet. And I was making, you know, $200 to $300 a month. This girl and I figured it was going to cost about $5,000 for all of this. And so the only way I could make that much money in a reasonably short time was to join a group of people, these foreigners I had also met at parties in Taipei, who smuggled watches to Korea. In fact, I just had dinner with them last night. They're all here in Minneapolis. hotbed of smugglers here. And so we got paid $400 US a trip. We'd pick up the watches. There was always the boss. We were just mules, and we'd pick up the watches, and we'd fly business class, and we looked like we were legitimate business people. And we'd carry 20 watches into Seoul, and we'd leave another 20 per person in bond, and we'd carry them through customs, and then the next day come out, fly to Tokyo, pick up the other watches, and then bring them back to Korea the next day. So we bring 40 watches into Seoul each time. These watches were all cost at least $1,000 per watch, and often as much as $5,000 per watch. But the duty was 100% in Korea. So the boss was making a lot of money, and so he paid us well. And so within about a year, I had saved. We didn't go every week. We went at least 2 weeks a month. Within a year, I had my $5,000. In fact, I had a little bit more than that. And so my wife and I finally set a date to get married. And the day we were getting married, the boss said, well, they were doing one more trip. They were doing a smuggling run that day. And asked me if I wanted to do half a run. And he'd give me and my wife free tickets and some spending money for our honeymoon. And my wife thought that might be too much of a hassle, so we turned him down. Everyone was arrested that day in Korea. Somebody, one of my boss's competitors, had informed on him, and they were arrested. And of course, the people I had dinner last night were I had to visit in prison, and it was a very traumatic experience for them. But they all got out after 6 months under presidential amnesty instead of serving the 10-year sentences that they got. But when you do things like that, and they're illegal, of course, the boss is always telling you, nothing will happen. Nothing. A slap on the wrist. But anyway, so I didn't go to jail. I didn't spend time in prison like as my father had. My wife and I returned to Taiwan, and I realized now that I'm married, I had to get a legitimate job. So I found out about, there was an English language radio station that the American military had left in Taiwan when they recognized China. And they had abandoned this American military radio station. They turned it over to the Chinese. The Chinese really didn't want it because they knew if they took it over, no one would listen to it. So they set up a non-profit foundation to run it, and it became the most popular radio station in Taiwan. And so they had a little bit of money, and they hired me. I got a job there doing local news. No one had ever done local news before, but because they found out I knew Chinese, they thought I could do local news. And I didn't even know who the premier was, but I learned fast. And so every morning I would go in around 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'd read 5 Chinese newspapers, or scan them, look for the top stories, and then compare their versions of the same story, and then translate and write English stories. I do about the ten top stories, and then once it was about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, I would start calling different government ministries for updates, you know, for on these stories, and try to arrange interviews with people in the government who could speak English. And so that's what I did for 5 years, and it supported me and my wife, and also this indulgence in self-publishing, publishing these Buddhist poems and Bodhidharma, things like that. And then my boss got hired away to go to Hong Kong and asked me to go with him. And that was in 1991, and he offered me this incredible job. He said, you know, we've got a lot of money, but we want something interesting. And if you could give us 2 minutes of fluff a day, you can do anything you want. And so I took him at his word. And I went to the mouth of the Yellow River, north of Shandong province, and I traveled to the source and gave him 240 pieces of fluff. Every day I would travel a little further and give him another 2 minute piece. And so this became my job for about 2 years. I traveled on the Silk Road all the way to Pakistan, and visited all the hill tribes in southwest China, visited all the Zen monasteries, the graves of all the great poets, and did these radio programs. And I saved $60,000 in 2 years. Well, I saved $30,000 in 2 years because I wasn't spending my money. I was on the road so much. And then the radio station wanted to keep my programs on the air, so they gave me another $30,000. for the rights. And so I came back to America in 93 because my wife and I had had two children and we wanted them to learn English or be able to speak English. And so I came back to America in 93 with $60,000 and found a house in Port Townsend with a cracked foundation that was $89,000. And the owner financed it. And so I bought a house. And I still own the house. And the mortgage, I still owe about $25,000 on it. But my mortgage is only $200 a month. So my wife and I feel just amazed that people like she and I actually own a house, because neither of us have had any real ambition. But so I came back to America in 93 and started taking care with my son, and later our daughter joined us, and I resumed this translation work that I'd begun a long time ago that had been interrupted by my radio job, because I was, the radio job was kept, tired me out too much to do much translation. And so that's when I started translating all these texts that I've translated lately, like these Buddhist sutras and the Tao Te Ching or Chinese books on Chinese poetry. And so since 93, my kids have grown up. I have our son is 27, and he sells a Trish McAvoy cosmetics at Nordstrom department store in downtown Seattle. And he's their chief salesperson. He sells, even in this market, in this economy, sells close to $1,000 a day. And I asked him why he's so good at it. He says, because I'm a total fraud. And so that's my son. He's very handsome, about 6'2", and he doesn't have an item of clothing that costs less than $200. He's a very sophisticated fraud. And I have a daughter. We have a daughter, 22, and my son's name is Red Cloud. Although when I gave him that name, John Blofeld, a friend of mine who helped get me started in translation, insisted that I give him another name because he knew he couldn't handle that eventually. And so I called him William Red Cloud because I didn't know of a better name than my own. So he goes as under Will now, or William. So I have a son named William, and we have a daughter named Iris who's 22 and works at a place in downtown Seattle, sells Russian pastries, and she's hoping to have a career in fashion design someday. She went to school trying to study that, but flunked out because she wasn't ready for that. You know, I think it's because she discovered boys and living by herself at the same time. And it was just too much. And also going to a school where they actually expect you to pass to study. Because, you know, in high school, you're often just passed along, whether you pass the exams or not. So those are my two kids. They both live in Seattle. My wife and I have been married almost 29 years. We never lived together except until 8 years ago, because part of the marriage agreement, in addition to the furniture, was that she couldn't live with me. She had to live with her parents and take care of her parents because they had no sons. There were three daughters and no sons, and she was the youngest. And so she stayed in town in Taipei with her parents, and then on Saturday she'd come up the mountain and stay with me. And it was really a nice arrangement, and I highly recommend it if you don't have children. Once you have children, of course, you sort of miss your kids. So my wife and I finally, she retired from this job she had at the phone company after 27 years, and about 8 years ago she moved to America and joined me and our kids. And now she lives in Port Townsend with me, and I built a fence around our property now so she gardens so that the deer don't eat our vegetables anymore. And so, see, that's about all I can say is I live in this town called Port Townsend, and it's about 2 hours from Seattle. You can take a ferry across Puget Sound and then drive for maybe an hour to an hour and a half. So it takes about 2 hours to get there. Or you can drive around the whole Puget Sound and get there also in two hours or 2.5 hours. And this little town, Port Townsend, is a little old Victorian seaport town that never really developed. And that's where I live. And what I do every day is I get up around between 7 and 8, and I meditate for about 45 minutes, and then I start work. And my work is just to turn on the computer and to do the translation work that I'm doing. For example, right now I've begun working on the Lankavatara Sutra, the sutra that Bodhidharma encouraged all his disciples to study, which was translated about 70 or 80 years ago by D.T. Suzuki. So it already exists in English, though hardly understandable English. And so that's why I'm translating it again. So what I do is, for example, there's three Chinese versions of the Lankavatara, and there's two Sanskrit copies. And there's a recent translation of the Sanskrit copy into Chinese. And so what I do is I compare the three Chinese versions of each paragraph, and then I see what the Sanskrit says, both in the recent Chinese translation of the current Sanskrit text and also in Suzuki's translation of it. And then I use my Sanskrit dictionaries to track down terms just to see how I might render things that D.T. Suzuki is rendering, or how these other Chinese are rendering terms, because I want to, even though this text has been translated for the last, the first translation dates back around 450 A.D., that's 1550 years ago, but about 95% of all these different versions are identical. There's very, very little variation in them. So, but still, I feel like I have to look at every version, all the Chinese versions and the Sanskrit versions, and then I do mine, my English version. And I've already finished a rough draft of the whole sutra. But what I like to do is, because I tell people no Chinese person, and probably Japanese person either, would ever read a sutra. You would maybe chant a sutra, but if you're going to read it, you read it with a commentary. Or you listen to a monk or nun explain the sutra line by line, phrase by phrase. Either listen to that orally or read it in a book. And so that's what I do. And all my publications share this in common, that I always include commentary with any translation I do. So that's what I'm doing right now. I get up in the morning and start work on the Lankavatara. Working on a paragraph or so and going over my translation, and then starting, I have about six different commentaries I'm looking at to see what these different people say. And if they say something interesting, then I translate what they say. If they don't, then I make up something. I obviously don't use commentary that I don't agree with. If I have a different opinion of something, or I think something isn't really what the sutra is talking about, I don't translate it. I only translate things I agree with. So it's a sort of a defect of my style. I don't bring in the competition. I realize that translation, this act of translation, has become my practice. And so every day I practice with the Buddha. I'm reading his words in Chinese or Sanskrit, and trying to figure out how to say them in English, and also trying to figure out how to explain them. Because there's all this background information that we as Westerners need to know, that the Indians knew 2,000 years ago, but we need to know because we're all neophytes in this tradition. And so that's what I do every day till about noon. I spend 3 to 4 hours working on this text, and then that's it for the day. I my house is on a hill, and I walk down to the hill to this beach, and I walk along the beach and back up the other side of the hill, and it takes me about 40 minutes, and I take a hot bath in this clawfoot bathtub we have, and then I take a nap for about an hour, and I get up and I have some tea. I just drink some tea for about maybe an hour, and then I ask my wife what's for dinner. And then that sometimes involves me getting in the car. We have a car. My wife doesn't dare drive it because it breaks down a lot. It's an 83 Volvo, has over 300,000 miles on it. And it's, there's a, the whole vacuum system has been jerry-rigged, so it only gets about 10 miles to a gallon because it's this mechanic friend of mine has jerry-rigged it so it works, but not the way it's supposed to work. So I go to the market, and because the work I do, even though I know a lot of people in Zen centers use my books, my income is such that I qualify for food stamps, and I get $360 a month of free food. And so I go shopping and I buy whatever I want. Potato chips, ice cream, candy bars, it's all free. And it's actually a really terrible thing to have that power, to walk in the supermarket and know that everything here is free. And it's taken me a long time to develop the self-control to walk past the potato chips. And I don't make it past all the time. So that's what I do. I bring back the food. My wife grows some vegetables. We sometimes have vegetables from the garden, and then we have dinner. And then it's usually time to watch the Mariners, or maybe The Simpsons, or Star Trek. That's pretty much all I watch on TV. I'll watch TV at least 2 hours a night, I'd say. It's either Star Trek, The Simpsons, or The Mariners, whatever's happening. So I watch some TV, and I usually go to bed about 9 o'clock, and that's my day. And it's like that every day, unless I travel. And I sometimes visit Zen centers, like Tim invited me here. This year, this is the second Zen center I've come to, so it doesn't happen a lot, but I also gave a similar talk in Carmel in California at the Monterey Zen Center. I don't know if they actually have the word Zen Center in their name. And about once a year I go to China to do research and to gather materials and to buy tea and visit my friends in Taiwan. And that's pretty much my life, I'd say, right there. Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you, Bill.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Lankavatara Sutra? And that's one question. And also, do you have an expected publication date for it?
Yeah, I've got into the habit, and this maybe for about the last 10 years, I never work on anything without a contract. Naturally, you can't do this when you're first writing or first translating. You're just lucky to find a publisher. But once you get a few things published, and the publisher gets their money back, and maybe a little extra, then they know you're marketable, and so they'll give you a contract in advance. So I signed a contract for the Lankavatara this February, and with a due date of February of 2011. And so if I meet that date, it'll be published in the fall of 2011. But I think I might be lucky to meet that publication date. I've never been late on a publication date. I think it's a matter of honor to meet my dates. But the Lankavatara is really proving to be difficult. Not the text. The text is a piece of cake. What's difficult is devising the commentary to go with it. So I've just started working on it. I just did a rough draft of the whole sutra. So the Lankavatara is this conversation between this bodhisattva called Mahamati and the Buddha. And it's an exposition of what has since been, in terms of Buddhist philosophy, it's classified as one of the earliest known mature Yogacara texts. The Yogacara tradition began after the Madhyamaka, and in reaction to the Madhyamaka tradition of Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna being this tradition that's based on the Prajnaparamita that teaches emptiness, the empty of self-existence, and the negation of anything that has self-existence, which you might think has self-existence. And so it's often thought of to be a sort of a negative tradition, although it's not, but it's often thought of in that light. And the Yogacara arose in reaction to that because it's more positive. It's all about the mind. The Yogacara basically, in a nutshell, is everything is the mind. The mind is everything. And it's all experiential, and it's the text is an analysis of the mind and how you would approach every aspect of Buddhism with this as your view. And that's what the text does. Mahamati keeps asking the Buddha questions. Questions that anybody studying Buddhism would want to ask, because he wants the answers in terms of this Yogacara tradition and not in terms of the Madhyamaka or even the earlier Sarvastivadin or other traditions. So it's just about the mind, about the categories, the way of the mind, the way the mind works. The sutra is also, you could say, it's an encyclopedia of Buddhism, viewed of these topics in this encyclopedia, each one viewed from this tradition of self-realization. It's the term that occurs more often than any in the book is the self-realization, which you don't hear of too much in Nagarjuna. You do hear, but it's all about experiencing the mind, and not negating anything, not emphasizing the negation of things, but the experience of your mind, and that's sort of what it is. I really can't talk about it much because I'm just trying to figure out what it means myself, and that's why I say I'm having trouble with the commentary. I remember I had the same trouble with the Heart Sutra. I didn't know what the Heart Sutra meant until I figured out what the skandhas were doing there. When Avalokiteshvara looks upon the five skandhas and sees that they're empty of self-existence, I didn't know what the skandhas were there for. And once I understood the meaning of the skandhas, the whole sutra was very easy. And I really haven't figured out what the key is of the Lanka yet. And so I can't really explain it.
I don't know that Bodhisattva.
Mahamati? Yeah, he's totally unknown. He doesn't exist anywhere except in the sutra. He just comes out of nowhere, and he becomes the interlocutor, the person who asks the Buddha questions, just like Subhuti or Shariputra might in other texts. Well, this Bodhisattva Mahamati, which means great wisdom, is the person. And he, again, doesn't exist in any other text. And the earliest translation we have is Gunabhadra's, dated around 450 A.D. And then it was translated again around 550, and then again in 700. And then the fourth translation was about 10 years ago from Sanskrit. So there are four Chinese translations of the text. I compare each phrase and see what people are doing and see what Suzuki is doing, I spend a lot of time trying to figure out the Sanskrit, because to me I think the sutras have a poetic quality, or have a quality that poetry has, and that's that the resonance of words. And it's very important to get the right word, because the words are like little bells, and they start ringing with each other. This was the key when I was studying the Diamond Sutra. I translated the Diamond Sutra, again, comparing, there were six Chinese versions of the diamond, and I compared them all and did a composite translation. And I had no idea what the sutra meant. And so I just stuck it in a drawer and didn't know what to do with it. And when I was in Taipei once, this Buddhist master, his disciples asked me to translate the works of their master, and I said I'd come by their office, and on the shelf there I saw this big, huge set of books, and it was a five-volume analysis of the Diamond Sutra, but an analysis of the Sanskrit text, and not the Chinese. And I got a hold of that, and once I saw it was, this was in Chinese. It was a Chinese explanation of what the Sanskrit was, word by word, grammatical particle by grammatical particle, what's a noun, what's a verb, what's an adjective. It was a grammatical analysis of every phrase of the sutra. So for the first time I could see what Sanskrit was doing. through Chinese eyes. And as soon as I did, I realized the Diamond Sutra was a poem, and that the crucial thing that had been blocking my understanding of it was that was the understanding of key words. And these words all meant the same thing, and that word is body. And that the Diamond Sutra was about the body, about our real body. And any time I'd ever asked anybody, they'd say, oh, it's about emptiness. Because, of course, that's just the knee-jerk reaction when you ask them about the Prajnaparamita teaching. They say, oh, it's about emptiness. But, in fact, I could see the poetry in the Diamond Sutra, this resonance of words. And I kept seeing over and over these synonyms for the word body occur over and over. And so then I realized a knowledge of the Sanskrit, if I can access the Sanskrit of a Chinese translation, I can go beyond the Chinese and I can pick up on this resonance that existed in the Sanskrit but was lost in Chinese. Even though the Chinese has the meaning, there's something else going on beyond the meaning of the words. And so that's why whenever possible, like with the Heart Sutra, I then did the same thing. And now I'm doing it with the Lanka, making it a point to make sure I understand what anything in the Sanskrit, anything that might give me some clues as to the resonance of words and how they link up with in poetic terms, although it's not poetry. Oh, the Lanka actually is about 30% poetry, as these long poems. That is, the Buddha will give an explanation to Mahamati, and then he'll summarize his teaching in poetry. So that's what I've been doing lately, and that's how I work. But I don't know what the Lanka means yet, because I haven't found the thread. I've not heard that ringing sound that makes the sound go through the whole text. And of course, I'm hoping to find it. I signed a book contract. And I spent the advance. Actually, I spread the advance over four years. And when you do get advances from, this is not like big time money or anything. Like this is the most money I've ever gotten for a book, and it's because the publisher is a Buddhist. He's a disciple of Aiken Roshi. And his name is Jack Shoemaker, and he's, you know, been lifelong friends with Gary Snyder and Wendell Berry and Roshi Aitken. So he's willing to indulge a Buddhist publication like the Lanka, which is not going to make any money. In fact, he offered me an advance of $15,000, and I told him, how about 10? Because I appreciate him being willing to spend money publishing a book that's never going to sell. And so I get $2,500 a year. I've spread it out over 4 years. Because if I get too much money, the problem with getting a big lump sum of money for me is I could lose my food stamps. Because I got to report this. And whenever I get money that shows up on my tax form, then they find out down at the Department of Social and Health Services. And I really appreciate all this incredible welfare that I receive. I get free food. I get energy assistance. They even pay for all my Medicare. You know, my $130 or $40 a month I should pay in Medicare, they pay for that. So I've spread out my Lanka money over 4 years. But hopefully it won't take that long before the book comes out. So that's the Lanka. Yes, Susan?
This is a little bit of a pointed question. So I was wondering if you could say something about how Buddhism has affected your life and how you live it.
Well, it's confirmed this early feeling I had when money was removed from my life. And I know a lot of people worry about money, but I don't. And Buddhism has confirmed that and allowed me to know that life is just fine. That I don't need. It's given me the philosophical and the background to know that what I'm doing makes sense. That there's sense in not be desiring a lot of stuff. And so Buddhism, you might say, has given me just, is I know I'm not alone feeling. That I've got friends, Dharma friends, the Buddha being obviously one of them, and the path, the pioneer who's cleared the path. But I guess it's like that. And Buddhism has kept my life simple, too. Because if I if I was ever thought about indulging myself, the text I was working on would tell me every day the Buddha would be laughing at me because I'm translating the Buddha's words every day, and so he keeps me from getting out of line. And so I say that's how Buddhism has impacted my life. I think I might have lived my life the same anyway, maybe, but maybe not. I think I may have stumbled along the way a lot more, or gone off the path a lot. But the Buddha Dharma keeps me on the path because it keeps reminding me of where the path is. And why it's better to be on the path than off the path, and how good it is to be on the path too. Because I enjoy the kind of life I have. I feel like I have to do this work that I'm doing right now because I'm sure that I've used up all my good karma, and I need to start working on some more. I guess that's how it's impacted my life. But for example, I don't teach. I don't talk about Buddhism to anybody. My kids only recently discovered what I did. my daughter came home one day and she said, "My boyfriend showed me that you're on Wikipedia and that you and that you translate in Buddhist books." Yeah, and my son has always disdained my work, you know, because he's a very aesthetic guy. In fact, for a long time he thought he was gay, and then he just realized he was a very effeminate male. So my stuff he considers, you know, it's not art. I mean, it's not beauty. He's into beauty. So I don't, even though I do this work, I do it for myself, and I publish books that other people can find useful, but I don't talk to anybody about Buddhism or what I'm practicing every day. I just live an ordinary life. I have ordinary friends, and like I say, I watch the Mariners. In fact, this year, this March, for the first time, I went to spring training. I'd always wanted to go to spring training, so I went to Phoenix to watch the Mariners for 2 weeks, and it was sort of a good experience. But I was really disappointed because I'd always thought spring training must be, you know, a little more rudimentary. But everything is so slick; it's like show business baseball. And I was really disappointed. I always thought we'd have wooden bleachers and I'd be able to yell out, "Hey, Ichiro!" You know, but it was a real disappointment doing that. But that's the kind of things that interest me in life, and that's how I sort of live. So there's a Buddhist thread to my life, but there's all this other karmic baggage that I lug along that I haven't been able to put down. Yeah. Yes.
I'm not very familiar with the Diamond Sutra, but I wonder if you would talk some more about what you found of that meaning of body.
Yes.
And does it have to do with form or?
No. In fact, it's all about the Buddha's real body. It's about the when you study Buddhism, sooner or later you hear about the Buddha's three bodies, the Nirmanakaya, which is the body of manifestation. And then the Sambhogakaya, which is the body of realization or experience, and then the Dharmakaya, which is the real body. And by seeing all these words in the sutra, I mean, it just in the very first line alone, the Buddha goes begging in town with this bowl and brings back pinda, is a Sanskrit word. Well, pinda just means, if you look up in the Sanskrit dictionary, it means ball of rice. But if you look up at the second meaning, it means the universe. So it was when I started seeing this stuff in the Sanskrit and realizing that he's begging and for the universe. I mean, he's bringing back this pinda, and that's what he's eating. And then, in every paragraph after that, there's all this talk about the different bodies. And for a long time, it bothered me because the Diamond Sutra is about, well, if you do this, you'll get this really great body of merit. In fact, if you read all the other translations that anybody's ever done, they'll always say, you get this big accumulation of merit. And I thought, well, that's sort of corny. You know, you're just doing this in order to get some merit. But the fact is the word that they use for this accumulation is this word skanda. Well, the original meaning of the word skanda is body. The original meaning is a tree trunk that with arms. And from a distance, a skanda looks like a human torso. And so punya skanda, which is the Sanskrit for accumulation of merit, is actually body of merit. And so then I realized that this body of merit that you acquire, and you acquire this body the moment you vow to save all beings. And after I read some more early, the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana, for example, a really great philosophical text of early Buddhism, explains how when you make this vow, you attain the Sambhogakaya of the Buddha, of your Buddhahood. And so this body of merit is actually none other than the Sambhogakaya. It is the body of realization is the body of merit. And that this whole teaching, and as you go through the sutra, you begin to realize, because of these words that are occurring in Sanskrit, that in fact the Dharmakaya, the real body of the Buddha, is the teaching, is the book. That's the body of the, that's the real body of the Buddha, that's not subject to creation or destruction. It's just the Dharma. It's just the book itself, the teaching itself. So anyway, this is how when I read these things and I start picking up on words and trying to see how this word resonates with that word, and sometimes I don't find such words, but so far I always have, like in the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra, not in the platform because that's not Sanskrit, that's just Chinese. But in the Lanka, I'm finding some of this, but I haven't found the whole thread yet to tie it all together. But that's how the body works in Sanskrit, is in the Diamond Sutra. And even at the end of the Sutra, the Buddha talks about the whole universe. So and when he does, he uses the same word as the first line of the Sutra, pinda. And he takes, instead of using pinda at the beginning, just means going to beg for this ball of rice. But in the last, in the second to the last chapter of the Diamond Sutra, he uses the same word, pinda, and it means the whole universe. So it sort of confirmed my understanding of the resonance that pinda has in this, and that skanda has in this, and that all these other terms that mean body in the text. Yeah, Larry?
Yeah, you were just saying a few moments ago, speaking of skanda, you were saying that when you were studying, translating the Heart Sutra, that when you realized what the skandas would be, that kind of different.
Can you speak up, Larry? Excuse me.
Yeah, he's wondering.
I was saying that you were talking about the skandas a few moments ago, and that when you realized what they were doing in the Heart Sutra, that kind of opened it up for you. Can you say something about that? Was that sort of kind of what you were saying yesterday about the reaction to the Sarvastivadins, or something else? Or?
Well, yes. Well, I didn't know what the skandas... Well, I could see how skanda worked in the Diamond Sutra. It was working as body, as a synonym for body. But I didn't follow that to beyond that. But after the Diamond Sutra, I translated the Heart Sutra, and this word skanda appears again, but it appears not as punya skanda, that is body of merit. It appears as the five skandas. And if you read any translation of skandas in English in anybody's book, it's usually pile or accumulation or, you know, a bunch of junk. And so I had already translated skanda as body, but I really didn't know. It was Avalokiteshvara looking down on the body. There are five bodies, and it was only then that I realized, because I'd never studied the Abhidharma, and the skandhas are the basic categories of what's known as the Abhidharma. And I'd always ignored that because it was too analytical for me. It was too much like school. But it was then when I realized that I had to understand the skandhas, that this body, in fact, was the universe of our awareness. And that the skandhas were five different ways of looking at everything that we're aware of at any given time. That the skandhas are the limits of my awareness right now. And that if I look at my awareness, my consciousness, whatever you want to call it, I can confront it or see it as having that there's an external aspect to it. And we could call that the world. But I'm having this... All I know is I have this experience. Now, philosophically, we can't prove the existence of the outside world. All we really know is we're having some experience. And when we first confront that experience and we try to do something with it, explain it, or we have this question, this doubt that occurs to us, What's going on? Of course, maybe you have this when you're pulled out of the womb, but eventually throughout life you have these moments when you're wondering, what the hell's going on? Who am I? But all this who am I stuff and what's going on all comes back to one experience that you're having, and that's all you really know. And the skandhas are five ways of dealing with this. You can look at your experience as something external and internal, that there's some kind of divide. I'm standing here, my experience is somewhere on this borderland between external and internal. And this was, again, as I said yesterday, the earliest Buddhist conception of reality was as external and internal. Rupa, nama. Nama rupa actually the Buddhists got this from the Brahmins. They believed in that there was that our experience has an external aspect, and we call that form. Rupa is always translated form, but it does not mean material world. It does not mean matter. It means outside. That's all. I'm somewhere in between. I can't find really where I am, but I know that I'm sort of hypothetically saying there's something outside me and there's something inside me. And so this is where the skandhas come from. The rupa is the external world and the nama becomes these four other skandhas. Well, I can see this internalness of me, of my experience, in terms of sensation or perhaps the categories that allow me to talk about sensation, which is perception. Or we can talk about where these categories come from. Memory, which is the fourth skanda, or the third internal skanda. And what we can just talk about is as consciousness. And so these five skandas that the Buddha was teaching to his flock as such, was often misinterpreted as being somehow inside the body or something, or talking about the body, when in fact all it's talking about is everything we know, everything we experience, has nothing to do with matter. It's all about us and how we experience things. It has nothing to do necessarily with a body. Maybe there's a body, maybe there isn't. And of course, we as Westerners have gotten used to saying our mind is in our brain. But according to the Buddha, according to this approach, the brain is in the mind. The body is in the mind. Everything is in the mind. The whole universe is in the mind. Because all we know is that we're having this experience. And then again, the skandhas was just his way of letting people realize that there's nothing in between. Because we all have this in-between feeling, and we call it us. We give it a name. I'm Bill. And I have there's this self. I guess there's a self. I don't really know there's a self until I go explore. And so the Buddha taught these skandhas so people could go exploring. And you could look in the outside world. You could look look at your own awareness and treat it as external and try to find a self there. Or look at your awareness in terms of an internal existence and try to find a self among your sensations or your perceptions or your memories or your forms of consciousness. And of course, the Buddha teaches this because as you explore these skandhas, you come up empty-handed every time. You can't find a self there. And so suddenly with this experience of selflessness, you don't lose your experience. Your awareness doesn't disappear, but the ability or the interest in grabbing hold of any aspect of it and calling that me or mine disappears. And you begin to learn to let go. And that's why he taught the skandhas. And that's what the skandhas meant. And then as you go from the skandhas, you can look at the skandhas at the same experience differently in terms of 12 categories, which are the 12 ayatanas, where you have these organs of sensation and realms in which sensation takes place. Or you can look in terms of the 18 dhatus, where you have the organs of sensation, the realms in which they operate, and the forms of consciousness that arise when the two meet. Those are the 18 dhatus. Or you can look at this experience we're having as a temporal sequence, from beginning with ignorance and ending in old age and death, the 12 nidanas. Or you can look at this experience we're having in terms of the Four Noble Truths, because the Buddha studied the 12 nidanas and was enlightened when he realized that they have no self-existence. And thus he realized that there is an end, that there's not only suffering, there's an end to suffering. And the end of suffering is the Eightfold Noble Path. And so you can try to find a self in any of this too. And so this is what the Heart Sutra does. It goes through all the different ways the Buddha taught in each of these ways, the skandhas, the ayatanas, the dhatus, the nidanas, and the satyas, the Four Noble Truths of the satyas. Each of them do the same thing. They just address the experience you're having right now and provide you with ways of looking at it. And in order to see the depth at which there is no self. But yet, without deny, you can't deny the experience you're having. All you can do is deny you. And thus liberate yourself from yourself. Or you could say, liberate this experience from selfhood. And this is what the Buddha was teaching in the Heart Sutra. And it's so easy to, once you deny all of these or deny that there's a self in any of this, it's very easy to get attached to emptiness, the concept of emptiness or some other concept. And so that's why the Heart Sutra, instead of supplanting the skandhas with something else, teaches us, just gives us a mantra, just a bunch of sounds to say, gatte, gatte, into the gone, which means into the gone. So chanting this mantra, I'm reminded, because these words mean something, they remind me to go into the gone, into that which is gone beyond, to leave words behind, leave the skandhas behind, leave all these things behind, and just put myself there and see what falls away and what's left. And this is why people chant this, people meditate on this. Of course, this is just one of many Dharma doors. There's lots of ways to approach enlightenment. And the skandhas, though, was one of the earliest forms the Buddha used. And he used it more than any other form. When he taught people meditation, he would say, study the skandhas, feel the skandhas, and realize that they're impermanent, that everything that goes on in any of these ways of looking at your experience, if you make any divisions at all, you see these divisions passing. Everything changes. There's all this impermanence. And because everything's impermanent, there is no there's suffering. Because you get attached to something, it passes, it dies, and you suffer as a result. But because there's no self-existence, because there is no self-existence in anything, you can also let this go. You can become detached instead of attached. That's why this kind is Rebecca. Monica, I'm sorry.
I'm wondering about your translations of poetry. And, first of all, if you have any plans to do any more. And secondly, if your understanding of the Dharma is different when you're working with poetry, or what have you learned from your translations of poetry as opposed to the translations of Sutra?
Oh yeah, sure. Well, I just published a book of poetry last month. It's poetry, Wei Ying Wu, a very famous Tang poet. And I don't have any other books on my agenda immediately. But I love translating poetry. It's very different from translating sutras. And I would be surprised if I didn't do it again. Because there's a press that'll give me a contract if I can... So it's great to have a publisher that'll do that. But I'll probably translate poetry again, but poetry is very different. Well, a sutra, you know, they're long. Poems are short. The average Chinese poem is about 8 lines in the Tang Dynasty. That was the major form. Sometimes they're longer, but... So they're shorter, and they're personal. And they're not written by the Buddha. They're written by people sort of like me, you know, benighted, who, you know, studying the Dharma perhaps, and so I feel that I'm more on a equal plane with the people I'm translating, and so that's why yesterday I was talking about how I view translation, especially of poetry, as dancing, and of having this dance partner I'm dancing with. I don't really think of myself as dancing with the Buddha, because he's, you know, the Buddha. He doesn't look like a dancer. You never see him dancing. He's always just sitting there or standing there. So I have a different attitude towards sutra translation. Again, as I was saying yesterday too, when I translate poetry. I rely on bourbon because whenever you're translating, you're trying to shake up your translation. Because if I translate something and I look at it a few days later, I often say, that's terrible. You know, I mean, I've translated all the words, but it sounds, you know, really awkward. It's not good. There's no dance. There's no movement in it. There's something's not right. And that's where bourbon comes in. But I just say bourbon, just because it's sort of a joke, but not really. But I use tea just as much as bourbon, and just time itself. So in translation, I'm trying to shake myself up. I don't get stoned anymore, so I don't do that anymore, because that just puts me to sleep. But I do like the idea of a little inebriation, just so it can force me to look at things differently. But I would never do that with a sutra, because I view the Dharma a little differently than poetry.
Do you feel like there's maybe a different perspective of the Dharma that comes through poetry, or a different expression of the Dharma that comes through poetry, or do you feel like they're pretty similar?
No, they're not. I've found that most Dharma poetry is bad poetry. I have found very, very few poets, Dharma people, Buddhists who write good poetry. I only know of two in Chinese, Cold Mountain and Stonehouse. There's a couple others. There's Han Chan De Qing, who I've translated a little bit of his poetry. No, there are more.
What about, you know, even non-Buddhist poets who express the Dharma? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Not in a literal expression, but, you know, just the...
I like that a lot better.
Yeah.
I usually don't like the Buddhists writing poetry, mm-hmm. because it often becomes doggerel.
Sure.
You know, it becomes too heavy with devotionalism, mm-hmm. or terminology, and it's really hard to find a poet who wears their robe lightly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a monk who wears their robe lightly, and where the poetry itself dominates, and where the Dharma is sort of slipped in there. And you probably see it more in Japanese Dharma poetry than Chinese. I haven't found a lot of Chinese, and I don't read Japanese, so I can't translate that. So, but there are very few Chinese who really have let their Buddhism go to the extent that they can write good poetry. And usually it obstructs them. They think of their poetry as proselytizing, or as conveying the Dharma, instead of just writing a poem. Yes.
I was wondering, since you've gone back to the Sanskrit and looked at the translations into Chinese, have you gotten a feeling for the translators back then?
Oh, yes.
Can you have any kind of feeling or something to share there?
Well, it's, you know, one thing I have to be careful of is that even though I can see what's going on in the Sanskrit text that we have today, and I can see what this Indian translator was translating into Chinese 1500 years ago, I can never be sure that he had the same text that I have, because Sanskrit texts also changed over time. But one time, after I brought my son over to study to learn English in America, he had such a bad experience in Port Townsend because he was the only non-native English speaker, and they had no ESL programs, and he just sort of was drowning in school. And so a couple years later, we brought our daughter over, and I decided I wasn't going to replicate that experience. So I called up these people I knew in Northern California that had this place called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And I thought, I knew they had a boarding school for boys and girls. So I said, could you put my kids in your school for free? And then I come down and I teach some classes. And they said, sure. And so we did that. It was almost a disaster because a week after my son was in the boys' boarding school, they kicked him out, made him live with me at home. They gave me a little house because they said, your son has dyed his hair a shade of chestnut. And that's not acceptable. He's got to either shave his head or wait till it grows out and have it cut. Because even though his hair color is brown, this is not his natural brown. And I thought, wow, that's really, you know, strict. And then about 2 weeks later, they called me in for a conference about my daughter. They said, you know, there's been a lot of complaints about your daughter because she goes home and you help her with her homework every night, and nobody else gets that kind of help. I said, well, but she doesn't know any English, and I've got to help her. And they said, well, sorry, you've got to stop doing that. And so I took my kids out of the boarding schools and put them in the local public schools where 25% of the kids didn't speak English, and so where they flourished. But I had these classes I had to teach. And one of them was translation, and I began with 20 students. They were all monks and nuns. There were about 250 monks and nuns, all Chinese, who lived there. There were three or maybe four Westerners, and the 245 Chinese. And so there were about 20 of them that decided they were going to take my class in translation. And so the first day I told them some of the things we were going to do, and I said, one of the things I thought that would be really interesting is to go over some of the translations of Kumarajiva. Kumarajiva is the greatest of all translators, lived around 400 AD, and his translations are the most beautiful. Nobody uses Xuanzang's translations except of the Heart Sutra, because his he didn't know how to dance as a translator. His translations are very literal, very very wooden. But Kumarajiva just dances and sings, and his translations are the most beautiful Chinese. And that's because when he was, the emperor actually sent an army on the Silk Road to bring to the Silk Road oasis of Kucha to get Kumarajiva, and the local king would not let him go, so they had to conquer the town, and then they brought Kumarajiva back to China. And they got halfway there, there was a coup d'etat, and the emperor was overthrown. There was a new emperor, so the general who was bringing him back just held Kumarajiva as a hostage for 17 years in this town called Muwei on the Silk Road, and Kumarajiva took the opportunity to learn Chinese, and his Chinese was just the most beautiful Chinese. So I thought Kumarajiva is the greatest of all translators. Certainly these monks and nuns would appreciate going over some of his translations. And I said, so one thing I want to do is point out some of the mistakes of Kumarajiva. And the collective gasp in that room almost drained the room of air. That they couldn't believe that I was going to point out the mistakes or the poor choices of words that Kumarajiva had made. So there's a great deal of respect for these early translators, and I realized that by suggesting that they had made mistakes was itself a big mistake. And so I've never gone past that, and I've never gotten past that trauma. And so I can't really tell a talk specifically about the translations. I could if we had the text here. I could show how Kumarajiva obviously, you know, went for the beautiful language, which I appreciate. That's why when I said mistakes to them, I didn't really mean mistakes. I probably should have used a different word, because I'm the same kind of translator. I'm looking for beautiful language. I'm looking for the spirit that's going on, and not the superficial words. Sorry, David, I can't say anything more than that.
Can we look forward to a book on bohol maintenance?
On what?
Bohol maintenance.
Bohol maintenance.
Which is to say, do you have any plans to write on your own rather than translate?
In December I published this. I've only written two books. And one was this book called Road to Heaven, where I interviewed all these hermits in China. Mm-hmm. And I sort of provided a literary background of them historically. And then in December of last year, I published a book called Zen Baggage, where I did an account of a pilgrimage I took to Zen places in China. And I do plan to do something again. And it might be soon, because when I worked for this radio station in Hong Kong, I wrote 1,122 pieces of fluff. They're all 2 minutes long. And so, like, for example, there are 240 pieces on the Yellow River as I worked my way from the source from the mouth to the source. So I want to rewrite them into book form. And I took a lot of nice black and white photos, too. This is in 1991 to 1993. And so I do plan on rewriting all of those into a book form. But I asked my publisher if he'd be interested. He said no. I'll have to find a publisher. I know I'll find one, but I've never had to work for a publisher. Look for one. They just sort of fallen into getting things published. I enjoy writing. I didn't realize I enjoyed writing. The nice thing about writing is you can make it all up, and in translation you can't. So I really like that. Sometimes I feel an affinity to people who are storytellers, and so I'll probably rewrite my old radio scripts. But other than that, I don't know. I don't know what I'll do. I was actually just asked by there's a National Geographic, and there's a Chinese edition of National Geographic, and the Chinese edition. The editor-in-chief just asked me a couple weeks ago to write a 7,000-word article on comparing the two poets, Han Shan, Cold Mountain, and this one I just translated, Wei Ying Wu. I agreed to do that because if I could get published by National Geographic in China, I could sell a lot of books. They have a big market for book sales in China. Because Han Shan was the greatest of all hermit poets that we know about, and Wei Ying Wu is always ranked in the top five of China's greatest poets, but nobody knows about it in the West because nobody ever translated him until I did last month. The book came out, but he was a man who spent his life as an official, but always wanted to be a hermit. And so that's why they thought this is a great contrast. And especially it's important now in China because a lot of people have read my book, Road to Heaven, in China. I published it in 93, and it sold about 40,000 copies in America in the last, 16 years. But it was published about 2 years ago in China, and it's already sold 100,000 copies. The Chinese, and they've even formed a hermit association now in China to send people around with medicine to hermits and stuff. But the Chinese now, I get this because I get interviewed in China a lot, and I get the same question over and over. Do you think it's a good thing for people to go live as a hermit? And their question is rhetorical. It's obvious, like they're basically saying, you know, it's not a very good thing for hermits, for people to be hermits, because they're turning their back on society. They're washing their hands of the responsibilities. And do you think it's a good thing? So I get this question a lot. So that's why this magazine wants to compare these two poets: one who became a hermit, and one who served as an official, wanted to be a hermit, but he served as an official and did the good thing, did what he hadn't had to do. So it's the first time anybody ever asked me to do an article. So it's possible that I'll write a few articles.
Well, speaking of books and articles, I think we have to close now, Bill.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. But afterwards, if you'd like to,
that's
right. Do you have time to chat with people who are buying books?
Yeah, I'll be here for a while, and wherever, if there's a table set up somewhere,
right.
I can sign.
We have a table
in the front.
I'll sign. Course.
Yeah.
And we'll also have tea. So.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming today and indulging me in my long Dharma talk. And thank you, and I hope to come back again someday. It's really lovely, a wonderful sangha here, and Tim has done a fantastic job in getting this group together.